Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm excellent. Excellent. Doing very well. I'm excited.
I got to tell you, I feel like I'm in two places at once right now, because of something that's happening. I don't know if you've been following my other podcast, the one that I do for Zappoint called Transparency Revolution.
Yeah.
But you have been a guest.
I'm a one-time guest on that show, Phil. And I try to hear them all. I probably heard most of them. Yeah.
Well,
what's going on with that?
A couple weeks ago, we had Arnold Kling on, and I decided that we would have him on in the evening. That wouldn't work as a day show, so we did it the night before the Wednesday, and we did it on a Tuesday night, and we did it at 8 p.m. my time, which is the time this show airs. And wow, got a lot more listeners to Transparency Revolution. So I said, well, that's it. From now on, the show is going to be at this time, and not only am I going to do it once a week, I'm going to do it five nights a week. So now Transparency Revolution runs five nights a week at this time slot. So right now I'm here live on Fast Forward Radio, and I'm also over there virtually live, almost live, recorded just a little while ago on Transparency Revolution. So both shows are on at the same time. I don't know. I feel like I'm competing with myself almost.
That is awesome. You are the one podcaster I know has actually run two podcasts at the same time on two separate topics. So, you know, that's pretty awesome, Phil.
There you go. So I urge everyone to listen to this program here. But if you're at all interested in customer profitability, check out Transparency Revolution. That'll be available via archive here in just a bit. Fascinating topic in its own right. So I got that going on. Just before the program started, you told me about something very interesting that's about to happen in your community. Why don't you let us in on that?
Well, I don't know too much about it. I just found out about it today, but I'm excited about it. It's TED is coming to my area. TED is, of course, everybody knows what that is, right? It's the ultimate in interesting talks and presentations on the stuff that, if you like this program, you would be very much interested in. Go to YouTube, type in TED if you don't know what I'm talking about, but everybody knows.
Our inspiration for tonight's theme, the show we're going to be doing here in a bit after we deal with some preliminaries, was a TED talk,
finding a bad TED talk is a little bit hard to do. I'm sure with all the TED talks that there have been, there's got to be at least two or three stinkers, right? I can't point you to one. They're all very interesting. So anyway, TED is coming to Shreveport. It's going to be called TEDx Red River, and I guess to include the surrounding communities here, instead of calling it TEDx Shreveport, they're going to call it TEDx Red River.
You're going to have some Texans coming probably. I'm just warning
you.
Yeah,
that's right. Oklahoma, I mean, Red River stretches a ways,
Oh, yeah.
But
you have Nebraska.
Exactly. It's a stream up there, but they still got the Red River. Perhaps we'll have some people coming from all over. It's going to be interesting. As soon as I know some more details, I will post it at the Speculist and mention again next week. I hope to have more I can tell you. But, yeah, I'm pumped about that. That's cool. We do here in flyover country, we don't have the same kind of interesting stuff that, you know, our listeners in California or in New York or even in Denver, Bill, have. And so, yeah, you know, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be a big supporter of this.
Yeah, so. I think it's very cool. Well, in fact, I love this TEDx concept because, to your point, the folks who organize TED, and we've had the counter TED on, we've had the Bill folks on, we think they're awesome too, but the folks who organize TED do an unbelievably good job of finding what they promise. When you see the ads, it's like fascinating people, you know, world-changing topics, and that really is what they deliver, time and time again. It's a wonderful set of talks, and this program called TEDx, I think, is this idea of spreading TED out, you know, to the rest of the world, that it doesn't just have to be in these one or two prime locations, that it can be everywhere, that you can get people together and that you can find someone who's got an interesting thing to say about an important subject. So that's really cool. Keep us apprised of TED. I'm going to be looking for TEDx Denver here too. I'm going to have to. I have to make sure we...
Surely. If we get it in Shreveport, I mean, you know, come on. There's got to have been something going on in Denver about this, you would think.
You would think. You know? I'm going to check with Michael Darling. He's the guy who usually knows all things TED. I think he has seen every TED talk, that guy. So he's the guy to talk to. And, speaking of TED talks, we're going to get to our major topic, which is Life Beyond Limits, here in just a few minutes. But we've got a little bit of breaking speculist news that I think we have to deal with first. And that is the Kepler mission. NASA's Kepler probe has a remarkable milestone this week. It has confirmed the first planet in a habitable zone of a sun-like star. And this is an Earth-like planet in at least two respects that I've heard of so far. And, Stephen, if you've heard more than this, let me know. But it's roughly the same size. It's about twice the size of Earth. And they estimate the temperature to be about 22 Celsius, which puts it where, in like the 80s or something like that, right? I mean, so it's Earth-like in size. If it is a solid surface, if a human being were to stand there, it would be very difficult, but you could do it, right? The gravity would be it would not be like Jupiter, where you'd just be pinned to the floor, and the temperature would support life. There's still a lot to be said about whether it has a surface at all, if it's just liquid, or we really don't know too awful much about it. But it's got two major characteristics in common with Earth that no planet discovered up to this point has. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and those characteristics are that it's a rocky world. I guess the characteristics are it's in the habitable zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the other one?
That it's roughly Earth-sized.
Oh, okay. Okay, so, yeah, so
yeah,
it's...
I hadn't heard that that NASA confirmed that it's a rocky surface yet, so I might be working off bad info. I might have read it off the Daily Mail or something like that, and I didn't get all the stuff. Is that confirmed that it appears to be solid?
Yes, it does, and it's 600 light years away, and this is just very exciting because if you think about this, Bill, the very first exoplanet was only found, about 15 years ago, 10, 15 years
That's
ago?
That's right. That's right.
And, of course, the first exoplanets are these huge, three times Jupiter-sized.
They had to be freakishly big, freakishly close to stars that aren't anything like the sun in order for us to even have a chance of seeing them. That's right, yeah.
And so, we had these huge gas giants that were orbiting right up next to their stars that we could pick out because they dim the stars as they pass, and it was we were finding those and finding them fairly. It turns out that they're a lot more common than you would think, and then we began to see smaller and smaller gas giants until finally the first rocky planet was found, but that was just a couple of years ago, not very long ago at all. And here we're seeing now an Earth-like planet within the habitable zone. This is just very, very cool. Our ability to find these things is shooting up. And so, 600 light years away. It's a long
not
trip,
close, but
it's not suppose. Yeah, I mean, it's not like, and I mean, in a way, this is, it's sort of interesting that we were able to spot something that far away. You know, I mean,
yeah.
This isn't Alpha Centauri, you know, 4 light years away. This is a long, you know, long haul away, and
they were still able to find it. Yeah, a good chunk of, I wonder in Star Trek terms if that would even be in our same quadrant, right, of the galaxy.
That's right.
That is a long way off, and it seems that that doesn't impact the resolution with which we're able to make these determinations. So, if you draw a 600 light year radius and put a sphere around our solar system, that's a huge volume of space in which we've got now to identify additional planets and find even more Earth-like ones, and eventually we're going to find some planets that I think are probably very Earth-like indeed. Will we find life? I don't know. I mean, the detection technology that we're currently using isn't going to show us life, but we can increasingly find planets that are candidates for that, and that if not candidates for having life on them, are good candidates for us to go put life on them at some point. So there's a there's a lot of just interesting and exciting stuff about this. Here's the other thing that caught my attention about this one, Stephen, and this is a subject we've talked about before. In some ways, it's been argued that all of this acceleration that we describe has kind of slowed off where it comes to space exploration, that we had a huge acceleration of the ability to move faster, to go higher, et cetera, that kind of culminated with Apollo and then really dropped off after that. And my argument to that is, well, but at the same time, we've done amazing things with robots. We've got Voyager, the original Voyager probe is now truly just about the interstellar space. You know, we keep sending robots to Mars. We keep sending robots out into other parts of space. And if you don't count anything else, just look at the number of planets we've discovered, right? When it used to be this huge shrieking headline, when Pluto was discovered, and then there was this huge gap, and then suddenly, hey, we've discovered another planet, and now we've discovered a few more, and then for a while I was keeping tally on the Speculist. I have not bothered even to check in how many planets have been discovered. All I know is that the big headline this week was that Kepler had identified a planet in the habitable zone, an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of a sun-like star. The side note, the little, oh, by the way, the thing that is five or six paragraphs below the lead that a lot of people never even read. And by the way, they've detected probably about another 1,000 planets.
Well, Matt says in the chat room that, you know, I assume he means before Kepler got going on this particular project, there was about 700 known exoplanets, and that it's estimated that there'll be a million known exoplanets by 2020. You know, I don't doubt that. Our ability to pick these things out is increasing. And, you know, it's interesting. There's even the opportunity for, you know, normal people like you and me, Phil, to go data mining and be able to point to planets that have not been discovered yet in the publicly available data. You know, you just have to get out there and do it. So
I've got to start doing that.
Yeah,
I so want to discover a planet. I think that would be a pretty
odd. You gonna name it Phil, or what? How would you?
I'm not sure. I have to think about that. I might name it Sexy Immortal. I don't know. Super fantastic.
Better all the time.
Bat. There's a lot of possibilities. I don't know. I got a dog named Barney who deserves to have a planet named after him, I think. So there's a lot of
possibilities. Orbiting the dog star.
Yeah. while we're in the chat room, I just want to, you know, I'm taking a nerdy side turn here just for a moment before we get into our actual show. But on the 600 light years distance, that being an extended vacation, Sally says we'll need very extended lifespans by then. Actually, all we need are really fast spaceships. And you don't have to go faster than light. You just have to go near light speed, and then you get the time dilation effect. And, in fact, if you're going about 90% of the speed of light, you can get to that 600 light-year away planet within your lifetime, probably within, subjectively, just a few years. Now, the problem is when you get back to Earth, you need extended lifespans there, because otherwise everybody that you ever knew on Earth is going to be long gone. But
yeah.
sorry, I just, you know what, when I see that argument, I have to jump in and talk about time dilation. Okay, well, there it is. Let's get our actual program going. So tonight we're going to talk about life beyond limits. And my inspiration, as I said, for this was a TED Talk, and it was a TEDx Talk, TEDx Orange Coast. And what a remarkable story. For those who haven't followed the link over at the Speculist, please do, and we should put that up in the chat as well. A young woman named Amy Purdy, and she talks about the experience that she had as a, 18, 19-year-old young person right out of high school, has her first job, living, I wasn't clear where she was, but someplace where there's snow. She's a big snowboarder, and she develops a bacterial derivative of meningitis. Is that right? Bacterial meningitis. Becomes
correct.
Very ill, nearly dies. I think at one point she says that the doctors give her less than a 10% chance of survival. She does make it through, having lost the hearing in her left ear, her kidneys, her gallbladder, I believe, and both legs below the knee. So survived, but what a traumatic thing to have happen to you at such a young age, and someone who had all these dreams of, snowboarding and you know, being an athlete and those kinds of things, just an absolutely devastating experience. And she talks about the kind of transformation that her life went through as she began to make – she goes through a long period of depression and then begins to kind of adjust her thinking around what her life can be. And if her life, the example she uses is if her life was a story and she was the author of it, how would she want it to go from now on? And she talks about the importance of imagination in allowing her to see new possibilities for what her life can be. And here we are, I guess about 11 years later from the time that trauma has occurred. She's standing on stage. She looks great. She's a very attractive young woman. Walking around, you would, Stephen, you and I were talking about this, you would never guess that she was on artificial limbs. And she is an accomplished world champion snowboarder.
Absolutely. She she is ranked, and she gave the rank and basically said it makes her the highest ranked adaptive snowboarder in the world. I guess men or women. In other words, she of all people who are handicapped, or whatever word you want to use to describe what she is the best mm-hmm. in the world, and among the best in of all of us. So she is just an inspiration, and so how do we apply that to ourselves? I think there's a lot to be said about this. I mean, for one thing, life never goes as planned. For anybody, there's always
right.
setbacks, and given the setbacks that you've had, how would you want your life to read if it were a story, going forward? And that's an absolute that's an important question to ask yourself from time to time, particularly after you've had some major disappointment in your life. And so
it's an important question for all of us to ask. And what's so powerful about her story is that you think about your own circumstances and how raw a deal you felt like you've gotten on occasion. Right. And how you'll sometimes think, well, I probably could have blah, 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 if only, things weren't. And, it makes you really question, how good your excuses are for not doing the things that you said you really want to do. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned the word handicapped, and the word disabled comes to mind as well, because those are both terms that theoretically would be applied here. And it goes to show you that this is kind of where technology is putting us now. How handicapped is she? How disabled has she really been made by this? One of the kind of breakthrough aha moments she describes in the video is she's talking about as she's adjusting to her artificial legs and the fact that they're variable and she can swap them out and stuff, it suddenly occurs to her that she doesn't have to be 5'4" anymore.
That's right.
This is kind of a proto-transhuman idea right here. Okay, I mean, I'm not going to go removing my limbs so I could be taller, but once you're in that position, exactly. You know, technology says you can be 6'3" now if you want to. You can, and she talks about adjusting her height depending on who she's dating. Right, options that. Other people don't have, and we know.
Oh, the other is adjusting her feet to fit whatever's on the sales rack. You know,
whatever shoes she wants to wear. Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
I thought that was hilarious. Yeah,
interesting advantages to having technological, mechanical feet that are the product of technology.
You know, there is a scene, Phil, in the movie Dodgeball. That it reminded me very much of what you just said. You know, what your excuse it might be for, you know, being depressed or dropping out of whatever your dream is. Do you know the scene that I'm talking about?
Of course, yeah, where he meets Lance Armstrong in the bar in Vegas after he's about, yeah.
Yeah, Lance Armstrong says, yeah, I've been watching you guys play dodgeball. I've been rooting for you, so what's the deal? You know, why aren't you there? You're going to be late. He says, well, you know, I've quit, you know. Lance looks at him and says, well, you know, I thought about quitting too when I had, you know, cancer twice and, you know, I had to fight for my life and everything. But I'm sure you've got a good excuse. And then he just walks away.
What is it you're dying from?
What are you dying from? He says, it feels a lot like shame.
Right now it feels like shame, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah, that's kind of where it puts the rest of us. She's very inspiring in a kind of a what's your excuse sort of way, kind of in a Lance Armstrong.
Yeah.
Although she does not come off that way at all. For those who haven't seen the video, she's tremendously
seems like just a very nice person that we could all like to meet, kind of person. So yeah, very much of a. Just comes across great. You know, one thing I'm thinking about in watching this is that, you know, thanks to technology, not only are disabled people, the lines between, you know, someone who is disabled and someone who, you know, doesn't have those problems, those lines are getting blurred. But, I mean, we are, you know, having capabilities today, Phil, that, you know, people 10, 15 years ago didn't even have, you know. So, I mean, just think about cell phones and things like that. I mean, it's technology enabled telepathy. I know we've talked about that, but it's just such an amazing thing that it changes everything. And so things
Absolutely.
That were not possible before are becoming possible, and that's not just for disabled people, but it's for everybody. And so, you know, one thing I liked about her was that she's not sitting there waiting for somebody to invent the next artificial leg for her. She's actually getting involved in producing her own limbs for herself. If it's not quite what she needed to snowboard, she went out and did it. She made snowboarding feet for herself. You know, she found that there's nothing that was being provided that could do quite what she needed to do on the snowboard. So she did it. And
she personally did it. Yeah, I like that a lot too. I think that's.
Yeah.
That's an amazing part of the story, and let's talk about how this applies to some of the other things that we talk about at the Speculus. Because I actually think that her point about just looking at the same set of circumstances and imagining a different set of results, imagining the possibilities, and suddenly having a completely new perspective, and suddenly recognizing the possibility of a completely unexpected, and in this case, awesome set of outcomes, is a really powerful thing. And we often constrain ourselves by the limitations that we're currently facing, that it's difficult to imagine beyond the current limitations. 15 years ago, it would have been difficult to imagine that there's 700 planets discovered, and, you know, that they mention 1,000, discovering 1,000 more kind of in an offhand way. But that's the reality. The reality is that 20, 30 years from now, a lot of the things that we're severely constrained by, we're severely limited by, even 10, 15 years from now, will be no more, or will have become significantly lessened in their impact on our lives. And I've got a really simple example of this, but I think it's a very powerful one, which is a story that my friend Carrie Noel pointed out to me on Facebook, and the story was called Why Apple Will Dominate the Gesture-Based Future. And it's talking about something that I've blogged about both at Transparency Revolution and Speculist, and we've talked about on the show before, the fact that big is the new small, that computer interfaces have kind of made this leap onto smaller devices, onto smartphones and tablets, and our interactions with them have kind of become focused into these smaller and smaller spaces, while at the same time, gaming environments have shown us the ability to have these kind of full-body interactions with computer systems, with Wii, and what's the other one called? The
virtual reality?
There's another system like Wii. I can't think of the name of it, the other gaming.
PlayStation Move? It seems like they're all coming up with
everybody's
Wii
got
really
one now.
Start showing the way. So,
yeah. And in that world, right, suddenly your interactions with the computer are as big as your body is, as big as the space that that you're occupying. So where we've gone from this, big clunky keyboards and big mice down to much smaller laptop keyboards and little trackpads to finally, little iPhones that you're moving your finger around on and with keypads that your fingers are too fat for. This down, suddenly starts moving in the other direction. And the movie, what was it called, with Tom Cruise, the one where they had the Department of Pre-Crime and they were predicting murders before they occurred.
You got me on that one too. It was a great movie. It came out a few years ago.
I can't think of the title, but in that movie, Tom Cruise's interactions with the computer, I think, are actually probably very representative of the kinds of things we'll be seeing in the not too distant future. And in that movie, people are he's just like that computer is occupying whatever space around him he needs it to, and he's moving objects from one place in front of him, out of his view, scrolling through things. It's close to the beginnings of kind of a full virtual reality environment, but that's really not what's happening. It's just him interacting with data, but he's doing it using his whole body, using his entire field of vision, turning his head, turning his body, using his hands, using his legs to pivot. And I don't think that by and large people have come to terms with the fact that that's a very realistic projection of the kinds of capability we'll have. I don't think we'll be doing it all the time. I don't think anything that has occurred in terms of things getting smaller will go away. I think we'll still have all that, and the smaller things will continue to get smaller. But at the same time, I think we're going to have a lot of big interactions with computers, very unlike anything we've seen before. And this article, I'll put a link up in the chat room, talks about how Apple really has the advantage in going from small to big. That they have so mastered the user interface, both on the iPhone and the iPad, and even taking it all the way back to the original Macintosh, just the entire idea of a graphical user system of moving objects around and interacting with data as though it were objects in this kind of artificial space that they've created. That Apple has the advantage that will probably make them the premier providers of that kind of computing. So we'll see.
Yeah. In the article, they said basically envision a giant iPad with Siri-based interface, Siri version 12, based interface. And so they envision, you will, when you're using a computer, you will type very little, and when you do type, it'll be supplemented by autocorrect that actually works, and on and on. So it's just, yeah. By the way, that was Minority Report. They pointed out the chat.
Minority Report. Thank you. Yeah.
You and I both had it is amazing. We both had a mental block on that. But yeah. Any rate, and I agree completely. It's going to go that direction. I think that things will get smaller and bigger at the same time. So that,
right.
Instead of having an iPhone in my pocket, it will get even smaller than that. It will be embedded in my eyeglasses. And so my whole world will become the interface, right? But it's physically the computer itself is like, embedded eyeglasses to the point that it's, you know, you hardly would know it's there. So that's it's gonna be an interesting world. It's gonna be here really quick, I think.
I think the limitation that we've lived with all this time is the device. That's the thing.
Right.
Whether it's a desktop and it's the size of the screen, or it's an iPhone and it's the fact that you carry it with you and it's the size of that screen and the fact that whatever happens on that device is happening on that device. We're going to break the device boundary. I guess that's the point. Computing will and computing even seems an odd word for it, because we do so much on these devices that hardly feels like computing. But all of our interactions via these devices will transcend the device. They will occur in the space that we're living in, rather than on the screen that is in front of us. I think that's the big paradigm shift. And you're absolutely right. It is a simultaneous combination of things getting smaller and things getting bigger. The two feed each other. You almost really have to have one to have the other, don't you?
Yeah, and it's gonna. I can just imagine how remarkable that'll be. It's the whole issue of you don't have to know everything at the moment to really behave as if you do, because the information is just a question away. You know, Siri is right there, her successors are right there and are waiting with whatever answers you need to whatever problem that you have. That's pretty remarkable, and it changes everything.
Cool stuff.
And you don't even have to have all the computing power on board the device. Let's say I have, the device is embedded in my iframes, but if my question or whatever project I'm working on requires more computing power than that, what's in my iframes, there's the cloud. You know, it'll just be interacting with, potentially a supercomputer located elsewhere. And I'm just getting the readout by way of my glasses or whatever. So it's talked about in an article that you pointed to me by accident. I think you pointed me to an article by accident, Phil. An evolution towards a programmable universe. And in this article, they talk about exascale cloud computing. That's like past petascale. It's past everything. It will be the biggest computer in the world, although it won't be in any one place. It'll be the cloud,
right?
And you can touch it. Any device that can touch that cloud can use as much of the resources of the cloud as is needed for whatever project you're working on. I suppose if you're really a resource hog, you might end up paying for it in some way. But that's an amazing amount of power. And it says basically you'll be able to simulate things in your world to faster than the world is going by, so that the world itself becomes programmable. Now, I don't exactly understand. I don't pretend to understand exactly what that means, but it sounds pretty exciting.
Wow.
Perhaps you could come up
with an example.
I'm
glad I directed you to this article, Stephen, because I don't think I would have understood it had I read it.
I'm glad
I assigned you to it.
Well, I'm admitting that I don't understand it either. How does the world itself, the physical world, become programmable? I know in advance that something's going to happen because the simulation has already run.
In singularitarian terms, the world can become programmable when the whole thing's when the world you're living in is virtual. But that's not what they're saying, right? They're saying the actual external.
So, the actual external world is to the point that, well, perhaps, you know, it could be something as simple as this. I'm in my car, and a simulation is running as to what the traffic patterns are like in a particular area. It knows in advance, based on data that it's getting, that to avoid this street that street, and so I get to work faster because it avoids traffic congestion. It might be something as simple as that. But I get the feeling it has a lot more there's a lot more things can be simulated than just traffic patterns.
Well, we're gonna have to get the author of that article on the show, and we'll talk about this in greater depth. But I love everything I'm hearing, and the more I think about it, it seems to me that for the world to be programmable, you have to you have to make a leap from utility fog to computronium, right? If the world's made of computronium, then it's programmable. If
I don't think you mean it quite that literally. I don't think you mean it quite that literally. He's just saying that, you know, if you know things that are, if your computing power is so advanced that you simulate the world around you to such a great extent that you know with a high degree of probability what's going to happen next, and let's say it's going to be something bad, you can avoid that thing. That's your world programmed, you know.
Wow. So this really is like Minority Report. I mean,
yeah.
You start modeling,
yeah.
Right? You start modeling the behavior of people, and then you figure out which ones are going to commit a crime, and you arrest them before they commit the crime. Right? I mean, is that the sort of thing you're saying?
Yeah, and also he talks. He actually brings up the term psychohistory, and you know where that came from. That's Asimov.
Well, obviously, Isaac Asimov's Foundation series.
Exactly. So,
predicated on this idea of psychohistory, the science of predicting the future. Take sociology. It should have been called sociohistory, right? But behavioral patterns of large groups of people and it developed an algorithm that says we can now say exactly what's going to happen in the future. And I've always thought that was like, I mean, I love those books, but I always thought that was nonsense. Now you're saying, you know, we've got like one serious roadmap for how we might conceivably get there.
Exactly. And we wouldn't be talking necessarily about, you know, something, you know, that's weeks or months in advance. Perhaps, you know, the ability of these systems to look into the future would be very limited, maybe just a few minutes into the future. But that's enough to avoid a lot of catastrophe, I would think. And so that's pretty neat. So I just put the link in the chat room for our live listeners. So check that out. That's a very interesting article.
That is truly stepping beyond limits. When you start talking about that kind of capability. I mean, even before we got to the modeling the world faster than the world's happening and predicting what's going to happen next, just the exascale cloud computer, the one where everyone can have as much computing resource as they need to do whatever it is they need to do, that's huge. Is there a time frame in the article when they say that this sort of thing might be coming online?
Let's see here. He's talking like the next 10 or 15 years. He's
This is Moore's law gets us there before too long. I'm not surprised. And that idea, actually hints of one of my other examples, another set of limits that we're going to push past, I think, in the reasonably near future, and that is the limit of scarcity. I believe we are on our way towards a post-scarcity world. Had a great discussion over the weekend, it bled into this week, over on the Strong Artificial Intelligence group on Facebook. Sally was a participant in this, and I'll just read what the original question was. Stephen, you can tell me what you think. This was actually Ray Kurzweil, a scene that was deleted from Transcendent Man, in which he makes the statement, communism doesn't work in the present. Oh, I'm sorry, this is Juan Carlos Curry Pinto's summary of it. Communism doesn't work in the present, but maybe its utopias will work in the future. What do you think of that statement?
I believe that communism will never work. Communism as a system is flawed from the beginning, and I think will always be flawed. No, but I don't think Ray left it at that, did he?
Well, actually, Ray didn't say that. I was actually quoting one Carlos Curry Pinto. But in fact, I believe it was on The World Transformed that Ray made a very similar comment. It's interesting to me that they would have cut that out of Transcendent Man, because I'm pretty sure, I haven't gone back and checked the audio, that Ray said almost exactly the same thing on The World Transformed when we talked to him.
Oh, I know he did. He said on our podcast, Bill, he said that the goals of communism can be achieved through accelerating change. He is not advocating communism. He is saying that, you know, all these great things that the communists dreamed about that could never be brought, you know, into our reality by way of communism, because communism doesn't take human nature into account at all. It just doesn't. I mean, you know, if you're not awarding the people that are, you know, doing the work more than the person standing next to them, then everybody just kind of, you know, it just doesn't work. And so, communism doesn't work. But the thought that, you know, people can, you know, no one will have to starve. No one will have to, you know, healthcare will be universally available. These sorts of ideas and goals can be delivered, but it won't happen through communism. It'll happen, well, basically through technology enabled by capitalism, is my thought.
Well, and here's Sally quoting herself in the chat room. She said, "We will one day achieve the communist dream in a libertarian form through the workings of capitalism." And in fact, I think that's reasonably close to what Ray said. Not only through accelerating change, but I believe he did mention through free markets that they would be a driver in making that happen. And Paul Vasquez mentioned stewardship, and we should throw a shout out for the United Stewardship Alliance, also a group we follow on Facebook. Talking about a different kind of acceleration, which is people taking ownership of kind of doing the right thing by the world. But I think that it's very difficult for people to get their head around that. Head around the idea that you might get the ends of what one economic system talked about through the means of another one, because the limitations that we currently have insist that, you know, there's winners and losers, and not only that, but that the world is always going to look a lot like it does right now. This actually led to, I mean, Sally and I had quite a bit of fun talking about this. I think Sally and I were both branded temporarily as communists in this thread by at least some of the people reading it. And while
Sally,
you know,
is about as far from being a communist
about me if
as
they
anyone
want.
I know.
Can we just go on the record that Sally is not now, nor has she ever been, a member of the Communist Party? Okay, she is. She is clean. Okay, but
have you no shame, Bill? At long last.
At long last, actually not me. These other people are strong.
I know. I just hesitate.
I want to be very clear. You know, Sally is not going to be on any of those lists. Okay, she's fine. what I was saying was, once we cleared that hurdle, okay, Sally and I aren't communists. They might still be a little suspicious of me. They're pretty sure that Sally's not. It came down to a big discussion about post scarcity, and the lack of. I mean, when you go back to Amy Purdy's talk, and she talks about the importance of imagination. I think to grasp an idea like post scarcity, to really, you know, try to come to terms with it, to really cope with what the world might be like there, is a leap of imagination. It takes a certain amount of vision to do that. And I think that, like with life extension, would be another good example, it's just not an area where people currently are very comfortable applying a lot of imagination. One of the people I was back and forthing with there on that site was giving me this term infinite, and was saying that because human need is infinite, we'll never be at a point where everybody can have everything they want. And I tried to step him through it. No, there's a finite number of people, right? The planet has a finite amount of stuff on it, but the universe has a much larger amount of stuff in it. I mean, it comes down to how effective you are at managing the stuff. And also, what realistically people are going to want to do, even if everybody does get everything they want, not everybody's going to want the same things. The novelty of everybody can have their own Titanic probably wears off pretty quickly, I would guess. But you know, I kept coming up against this word infinite, and I realized that it's like we were talking two different languages. You know, he was using the word infinite to mean more than I want to think about. Right, and I was using the word infinite to mean infinite, and in fact, there is no issue of running. You know, there's never going to be an infinite amount of human need, because there's never going to be an infinite number of human beings. There might be a greater need than there is available resource, but the whole point of post-scarcity is the argument that there can be a greater resource than there is need. And what the argument ultimately seems to come down to is people coming back and going, no, because there will always be a greater need than resource. They're saying that the world you're describing can never exist because we assume it has to exist the other way.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, again, it's a little bit like you just mentioned life extension. That's a people are very uncomfortable. A lot of people are very uncomfortable with the thought that one day, life extension will basically push, the limit to when you that a person can live off into the unforeseeable future. People are very uncomfortable with that. I think part of it is that, in a way, if doesn't it make the tragedy of your own death even greater if we're just one generation away from seeing that? I mean, I almost made it to life extension, and I was one of the last to die of old age. I don't know. Maybe that's part of it, Phil. I don't know what it is. People have come to rely on, perhaps, the idea that, we're born, we grow up, we settle down with, a spouse and have kids, and, you have a career, and then you retire and live a little while, and then you die. It's just sort of a way of ordering your life, and perhaps people come to, just to rely on that to the point that it's hard to think of the possibility of any other way of living. So
I think that's true. I think that certainly in the case of life extension, there is a real fear of disappointment. There is a let's not get our hopes up about that thing,
right?
And that's very understandable, right? Because you don't want to be the last generation. You don't want to be the last person who dies, right? Who's going, hey, I think I'm going to make it, and then you don't. That would suck. There's no question that would be a bad deal. But
death sucks anyway.
Accepting that
so.
It's a possibility is one of the things that helps realize the possibility, right?
Right.
That's Amy Purdy's experience, is that coming to terms with the fact that she can make an interesting life for herself and a beautiful life and a valuable life out of the circumstances that she had, is what enabled that to happen. And I think that's true for life extension, and I think it's true for post-scarcity. But we have to let go of ideas, these kind of axioms that we have. I mean, it's a completely unprovable statement when you say that human need will always exceed the amount of resource available. I mean,
right.
What is that, a law of the universe? I mean, but people will state that as though it is. And they take it as, because it's so blindingly obvious that must be true, because that's always been true, and therefore it will always be true, right? That people have to get old and die, same sort of thing. It's always been the case, therefore it must always be the case. To let go of an idea like that, I think it takes imagination, it really takes a willingness to part from the way you've looked at things potentially your entire life. I guess, for some people it's a real act of courage when they start really kind of groping with some of these possibilities.
I think courage has everything to do with it. Think of somebody like Aubrey de Grey. What an interesting and beautiful life he is living, right? I mean, he is, whether or not Aubrey makes it, whether he is, if he's part of the last generation to pass from old age, the very fact that he is not accepting the status quo and he's pushing the boundaries, to me, he's a guy that's really out there. He is accepting the possibility that he could fail, but pushing on anyway, and that is an act of courage. So
I think so too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
My appeal to those who doubt post scarcity would be, consider the arguments. Consider why we think this will happen. It's not a failure to understand basic limits. I think it is a rejection of things that have been taken for basic limits that aren't real, things that are cited as must be true facts about reality that in fact are not necessarily true at all. So that's my post scarcity. I think Stephen, I know we've got music we want to get to tonight. Did you have one more topic that you wanted to use as an example of getting beyond limits?
I'm sure there was something.
I didn't want to go on and on about this. If you had another one, I was.
I'm sorry. Oh, there was one thing I wanted to mention. PlayStation. There's this. I thought this was a pretty interesting article. It was on Gizmag. It's about PlayStation basically taking their box and hacking it with PlayStation Move and iToy to create what amounts to a holodeck for someone's living room. I thought that was pretty cool. So imagine Minority Report where instead of just working on a wall like that, your entire reality you enter this a reality where you're able to push walls, able to design whatever it is you want to because you are completely within virtual reality. And,
now, how are you seeing this? Are you wearing goggles or something, or how,
exactly?
How is that?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a device called iToy that they're working with the PlayStation. So I think that's pretty cool. That's pretty awesome there. And so these things are very close. We think about these things like they'll never come to pass and then, until they're here. And then all of a sudden we integrate them so fast that it's not even a surprise anymore. You don't even we have fun with things like Siri. There's this hilarious video, not kid appropriate at all, about this husband and wife arguing.
I've seen that.
Christine
Peterson put that up on Facebook. I saw that. For those who haven't seen it, is
hilarious.
It on College Humor, I think? Yeah.
I think it's College Humor.
Siri and College Humor. That's hilarious.
Absolutely hilarious. And obviously Siri is this world changing thing, but sometimes human nature doesn't change as fast as the world does. So
let me tell you something about that. Let me tell you something about that video. I felt sorry for the phone, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you feel sorry for Siri? I felt so bad for the phone. I'm just like, oh.
Siri's like
searching for a place to hide.
I don't want to say that to her. And then another time, Siri says, "Looking for a place to hide."
A place to hide. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very understandable. Very understandable.
It's
well,
always
is,
the kids
no, this,
and the cell phones.
This is a topic for another day, but friendly AI. We're going to have to be friendly to them. How much of us are they really going to be able to take? is a good question to ask. But I'll tell you that that interface you're describing, I mean, that really swings us back around to what we were talking about at first. And because once again, you're leaving the constraint of the screen, right? And you're getting your entire visual field. And now I was talking about just for computing. Now you're talking about gaming. And think how that'll open up gaming. I mean, in the same way that the Wii and these other full body interactive systems have, this suddenly makes your interaction with the game very close to your interaction with the real world. I think people are going to have dedicated rooms in their homes for this. You'll want a space that's just kind of open that you can move around a lot in because you're going to have your game system in there and it'll be might even be something like, I mean, it won't be a holodeck in the sense that you would actually see all the stuff happening unless you had the goggles on, but it will sort of function as kind of a gymnasium or a holodeck. I think we're not far from people actually rearranging their living space to accommodate new possibilities that these interfaces are going to provide.
Absolutely, I can see. Some things are just going to disappear. In the article that was talking about the Minority Report type interface, you won't have a desk anymore. What you'll have is something that can be a desk. It could be completely flat if you wanted it to be, so you could interact with a flat surface, perhaps with another person across from you if you wanted to. But probably more often than that, you would probably have it at an angle, like a drafting table. And
yep.
Then there'll be other occasions where the same thing would be at a complete 90-degree angle to the floor, so you could watch it like a television. So it just imagines one system that does all those things, that takes the place of a desk and a drafting table and a television all in one. And, I completely agree. That's the way it seems to be going.
Very
so,
exciting. Well, there it is.
Yeah.
We've, We've touched on just a few examples, but there are many more examples of life beyond limits that we could give, and we promise that we'll come back to this topic again in the near future. But we've got some good music that we want to hear tonight. So, Stephen, tell us what that is.
It's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by Pornophonic. And I had to clean up just a little bit to get it family-friendly, but it's a catchy tune, so I thought everybody enjoyed it. So.
All right, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by Pornophonic. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us this evening, especially those of you in the chat room. Great chat this evening. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again next week with a brand new show. We hope you'll be able to be with us. And until next time, live to see it.
Give me an old school guitar, an 8-bit lo-fi stuff. I promise that I'll take you to the paradise in hell. And so again and again, we're playing this game. We wanna see our name in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.